What did we become aware of by way of an answer to these questions? Do we live the good life? Are we happy and at peace? Is the answer in the affirmative? Is it negative? What is the answer? Or is there no answer to these questions? All right, let me put it this way. Are we aware immediately of perplexity in ourselves in trying to answer these questions? Uncertainty, confusion. Or is it possible to give simple, straightforward answers to such questions after the fashion of answers to an examination paper? Are we not aware of striving? Or is there no striving to live the good life? Is there any effort involved in being at peace, in being happy? Or do we really experience, sometimes at least, spontaneous goodness, happiness, and peace? And it may be that we become conscious of it after the event is over. These questions really are very important questions. Note, the question is important. And our approach to these questions is far more important than finding an answer, as we commonly say. See, if we approach these questions intelligently, we will discover so much about ourselves. We will discover to what a great extent we are dominated by our separative self-conception about ourselves, that we are separate entities. Now, in actual fact, we are separate entities as far as the living body is concerned. Of course, one living body is separate from another living body. And because our life and our mind and consciousness is rooted in the living body, our awareness of ourselves and things and events and everything else is dominated by that physical fact. We are conditioned by it. Now, we have considered this matter before also, but have those considerations enabled us to be free of this domination by now? It hasn't, has it? One has only to look into one's own daily life. Observe the perplexities, the conflicts, the struggles, the upsets, the moods, the curious mental tirednesses which overwhelm us, literally overwhelm us. Bodily tiredness is another matter. If one uses the muscles and the body beyond a certain point, well, of course there is fatigue. The very process of the living body is one in which substances like lactic acid and so on accumulate, and of course there is fatigue. One must have rest, one must do certain things in order to recover from that fatigue, granted. But the mind, the state of awareness of ourselves in relationship to the whole, that is surely quite a different affair, isn't it? That is where one can remain eternally young, ever fresh, vital, alive, full of the zest of existence. Zest not to be understood in the commoner garden sense, permissive or repressive. Now, let us try and look into this domination over our lives by this separative self concept. Intellectually, we can see that whilst to all outward appearances, each living body is undoubtedly separate, distinct from another living body, another object, and so forth, every living body is related to every other separate object, is very intimately related. How has it been possible for this living body, which goes by my name, which is referred to as me or I, etc., whatever it is, how is it that this has come into being at all? Is it not due to the fact that all the matter of this planet, of our whole solar system, of the entire universe, literally, has gone into the manifestation of this particular body? If there were no Mother Earth, would I be here? If there were no sun, would I be here? If there were no planets, if there were no atmosphere, if there were no stars, etc., would I be here? Could I be here? This which I call myself is completely interrelated with all other bodies and objects which are separate bodies and objects. If then it is completely interrelated, then where is this separate self? As far as my consciousness of this living body is concerned, none in fact. Isn't that the case? But how do I live in the world? In terms of striving for myself, my interests, my concerns, and when I want to be a little bit highfalutin, my duties, my responsibilities, my obligations, living for the fulfillment of a great purpose, a great ideal, a worthwhile aim in view, and all sorts of things like that. But in every one of those cases, there is the very subtle, if not the overt, association of the separate self with that to which I am dedicated. And so it turns out as self-glorification. If that to which I am dedicated doesn't work out as I would like to see it work out, I change it. I give it up. No, this isn't a worthwhile cause. Something else is a worthwhile cause. But every cause, every purpose is part of the one total reality, the one cosmos. Isn't that true? If it is true, and I'm really aware of it, then several consequences inevitably follow. First and foremost, I am in right relationship with anything and everything, with any person. In the ordinary way, how do we meet? Do we really meet? Or are there barriers? There are walls, separating walls. Aren't there? Even between people who are supposed to be in very close touch with each other, whether in work or in business or personal flesh and blood relationships, etc., there are separating walls. We don't meet. And the fundamental reason for being unable to meet is that we are not really aware of this complete interrelationship between all people, all things throughout the universe. We are not really aware. Therefore, these walls and barriers exist. We meet conditionally, not unconditionally. We meet in terms of judgment, of evaluation, of criteria. And so we lay down, thou shalt be thus and thus to me, I shall be thus and thus to you. I come to do your daily chores, therefore you shall pay me 5 shillings an hour or whatever it is. And when the clock strikes 12, down tools and off I go. The conditions are laid down. And I meet you every day on those terms. If anything goes wrong with the terms, from my point of view, then I say, no, I'm not doing this. I shan't have any of it. I'm up against you. As and when things become too difficult, I smash up the relationship. Whether it be the relationship of me, the employee, to you, the employer, or me, the husband, to you, the wife, or me, the son, to you, the father, or whatever it is. Whatever the relationship is, if it becomes disagreeable to me beyond a certain point, I smash it up. But is this the way of life? Is it the way of the total universe? If you look at totality, you will see that it is infinitely patient. Of course, the brain will immediately challenge this. But you see whole galaxies exploding. Where is the patience there? A galaxy exploding displays no human patience, of course. Patience in our sense of the word. But a galaxy exploding cannot throw out that material out of the cosmos. It's all contained within. And in time, a new galaxy comes into being. It is there. The galaxy hasn't got brains or intelligence or the capacity for looking in inwards and seeing things for itself in the same way that a human being can do. Therefore, a galaxy behaves in accordance with its laws. And its laws include what we would call lawlessness. Its order includes what we would call disorder. When a galaxy explodes, it hasn't deliberately smashed up relationships because it got disgruntled. A galaxy explodes because of all kinds of temperature changes, pressure changes, because of the too close a proximity from another galaxy or whatever the cause may be. It had no option in the matter. You and I have option in whatsoever we do. It would seem that we have no option often. That is perfectly true. It would seem that we have no option. This, that, and the other force acting upon us is so strong that we inevitably blow up. But yet, right inside us is that power of option. But what is that inside us which gives us that power for option? Is it will, determination? Most people try it that way, and that way lies failure. That way lies ugliness, conflict, and so on. That way lies disharmony. But if one is totally attentive, so that selfness is clean out of that perception at that moment, the right thing happens. See, we right within ourselves are free. Never free to do what we like. Doing what one likes and being unable to do anything else is a miserable state. Real freedom is present when there is true perception, which means intelligence functions unhindered. When intelligence functions unhindered, it means that we are not striving, we are not struggling. One strives and struggles for a particular end, which is always a predetermined end. And every predetermination is dominated by our uncontrolled, unexamined desires. We are the slaves of desire. That desire throws up the predetermined end. And we will find that with every predetermined end, the shape of that end is determined by the passion for being happy. It is absolutely necessary to be happy. But happiness is there when it is not striven for. When there is no calculation to bring it about. When there is absolutely no predetermination of the shape of that happiness. This is what we find very difficult to see and live by. If we really saw, we would live by it quite easily. Look at the way our predetermination moves us to a course of action. It is a course of action in terms of time, is it not? I anticipate such and such a desirable result. And one of the inescapable elements of that desire is the pleasure drive, the consequent pleasure it will give us. So the process is a process in time. Now thus, tomorrow thus, day after thus, and finally the day will come when this wonderful, happy thing will take place. And all will be well forever and ever. Now this living in time is to live in terms of conflict, of sorrow, of death. The death which is destructive, which is the killer, which is, to use the biblical phrase, the wages of sin. Not death, the fulfiller, the consummator. See, if we look into the events of our life from day to day, look back just for the past month. Isn't this element strongly there all along the line? A desirable result. And one plans to bring it about. And it is all in process of time. Time, which means decay, which means the increase of disorder. This is an ordinary physical fact throughout the universal process. That a thing is thrown up, it starts into being, and then the disorder increases. As the scientist would say, entropy always increases. That means the state of disorder is continuously increasing. Once it started off. We will also see the opposite phenomenon, what we call order. Take the earth rotating on its own axis and revolving round the sun. There are millions of such demonstrations of what we call order. But what sort of an order is that? That's an order in undeviating obedience to imposed law. It is not the order which is born of freedom. The physical universe has no option there. It can display order only in terms of undeviating obedience to law. But if we look into our own minds and what we loosely call our spirit, of which we know nothing really, we will discover that order is freedom. Freedom which has nothing to do with any concept of doing what one likes, but freedom which means spontaneous emergence because of unpredictability and indetermination. Physical nature also displays this. But when it displays it, to us it seems like disorder. Within the atom, one sees certain phenomena which express this. Unpredictability of the behavior of the subatomic particles. Unpredictability of their behavior. There is a principle of indeterminacy, which is a funny thing to say. You think of a principle or a law as being something fixed, not as something which is utterly spontaneous and unpredictable, incalculable. But the story of our minds and hearts and the spirit is this kind of story. This spontaneity, this freshness, which is not license, which has no disharmony in the grand sense in it. It will contain both discords and concords in movement, exactly as we have in music, a succession of discords and concords, and the overall reality is the harmony. It will have discords, but it will be harmony. But you see, we are so conditioned by the world around us, by our own lack of perception, intelligent perception, by our own lack of understanding the true nature of things, that we miss this freedom. We talk about achieving or attaining a state of peace, a state of happiness, instead of being happy. If there is a real being happy, one is unconscious of it. One spontaneously is that, unconcerned, unanxious. There is no cloud, no confusion causing cloud in that state. Because immediately the question comes up, well, how does one do it? How does one do it is the wrong question. It all hinges, the doing, any doing, hinges round seeing. Truly seeing. Truly seeing implies also being the thing that you see. 23 centuries ago, Plato said that. He really knows who can do what he thinks he knows or says he knows. In terms of one's own inward growth, it means being. He really knows who is. And the being, the knowing, the doing are all one and the same thing in reality. The trouble is, all these things get left at the level of ideas, just so many ideas. Oh, that's an interesting idea. Because it's an interesting idea, it's a lovely looking deaf post. It's like a scarecrow in a field. Only we don't see the scarecrowishness of it. You might say, but being implies a state. And we know that the moment there is a state, decay sets in. The principle of disorder comes into play. And then death. Any state, it may in some instances last millions of years, like rocks and fossils and whatnot. They may last millions of years. Ultimately, there is decay and death, a breakup of a state. And you might inquire, then, in what sense is being, as I am talking of it, different from the ordinary states which crop up in everyday life and which are doomed to decay and death? There is a great difference. Being, which functions in terms of time, inevitably decays and dies. But being, which functions in terms of continuous creative renewal, is immortal being, and it functions in terms of eternity. But note very carefully, time is subsumed in eternity, and vice versa, eternity is also subsumed in time. It is I who separate the two, not merely understand in which sense they are different, but completely and wholly interrelated. I separate them. Then, of course, eternity is this, time is that, time is the undesirable, out with time, I'm going to live in eternity. You see how easy it is to be foolish? And therefore, miss happiness, miss peace. Happiness and peace are there. But I shall never know them. I shall be them all the time. That is all. All theistic devotees worship God and pray unto Him. So many will claim that they know God to this, that, or the other extent. There is one who simply doesn't know who God is, and that is God. He doesn't know he is God. That's why he is God. See, creation takes place spontaneously. Unknowingly. our ordinary knowing constantly spoils the reality of that which is. It makes it unreal. Maya, as the Hindus said, particularly Shankara. We make it illusory. The total reality is here all the time. The movement of that total reality, if unhindered, will mean that what we call transcendentally love, truth, wisdom, beauty, goodness, happiness, peace, all those things are effective and manifest. And they are seen by him who has eyes to see. Nevertheless, it constantly affects the others. A person may not go out into the sun ever. But nevertheless, the sun does affect his very existence, every moment of his existence, whether he goes out into it or not. If you don't want a sun, take a force like gravitation. Gravitation is constantly operative, whether we know it, acknowledge it, or not. It is there, and it affects us. Similarly, your realization, your being in this transformative, continuously transformative sense, this sense in which creative renewal continuously expresses itself, your being thus is affecting the whole world all the time. One must never seek to know or see how is it affecting the world. That's a futile search. It's the sort of search a man who wants to send in a bill afterwards makes. Spontaneity is out then, and there is no freedom under such circumstances. You remember some time back we talked about faith. You weren't here then. We talked about faith. To be faithful means to be belief empty. To trust, to give allegiance means to be totally trustworthy in relation to the unknown, the absolute. Otherwise, conditionality will enter into it. I shall be your faithful subject, your vassal, provided you are a good king, a just king, a noble king, which means you will be a king as I conceive of kingship. We do precisely that in relationship to God, to truth, to Brahman, to Atma, or use any word you like. We do precisely that all along the line and get deceived. Consider for a moment how we talk about the justice of God or the law of karma in operation. Millions of human beings the world over have complete confidence that God is a just God and that karma is a law which inevitably works out everything according to truth, righteousness, justice, balance, harmony, etc., etc. Now, you remember I said one or two dreadful things some time back? Truth in its transcendence includes all untruths and half-truths. This is a bit difficult. What we call the law of karma or the justice of God includes everything that is unjust and horrible and terrible, as human beings would see it. A few moments ago, we talked of this principle of indeterminacy and unpredictability. In past meetings, we have seen, at least I imagine we have seen, that as ordinarily postulated, conventionally, in the religious texts of the world, that God created the world is quite untrue. There is no such thing. Whether you look at the Upanishadic Brahman Atma, which became and is all this, or whether you look at the Judaic or Christian or Zarathustrian or any other text, God created the world. That's a totally untrue statement. This God is the God of my conceptions, my ideas. And what is more, what is presented in the religious texts as the creation of the world is really the emergence of images in my mind which are supposed to be counterparts of objective reality. And what I call God, what I call Brahman or Atma, the absolute, the infinite, etc., in that sense, is just that which is realized through this living organism in certain states of consciousness. And that's all. The question arises, how did the objective world arise? Out of the unknown, whatever the nature of the unknown is, probably that unknown has no nature. Out of the unknown, there is that energy which becomes this universe we see, which becomes these living beings we call ourselves. The Sankhya philosophy named it Prakriti. The Buddhists accepted the word Akasha. You will find this sort of thing coming out in Cicero, in Lucretius, in Greek philosophers. You'll find it in Western philosophy, all along the line. But Prakriti or Akasha is blind. Being blind, being unawakened, it experiments. Trial and error. There is ample room for accident, for chance throughout the universal process. There is no such thing as absolute strict causation throughout the universal process. We human beings also suffer because of that element of chance. When a bomb drops on my head, or my children's heads, or my dear ones' heads, and I know that all of us are such nice people, we have never done any harm to anybody, why? How did we deserve this? We are asking the wrong question. There is no question of deserving. There is no question of a judge pronouncing a sentence for wrong done, which is carried out in this way. It is an accident. And not one of us really knows anything more than that about it. And we say, this is horribly unjust. Look at the suffering and the cruelty in the world. Look at it. Really look at it sensitively, extremely sensitively, so that it really becomes unbearable. But stand firm and keep looking. It doesn't matter if it breaks my heart, because I've got a million hearts to take the place of that broken heart. There is nothing which will explain that away. That is how it is. Blind, unjust. There is no equilibrating law of karma operating and all that nonsense where such things are concerned. In other contexts, we see things which we understand better. We see relationships. We understand the process. And we see what appears to us as order and harmony. So we propose that there is a law of karma. We propound that God is a just God. Now you see, both are true. Out of this unknown blind energy which experiments, and where chance and accident and everything like that play their part, as well as order and harmony play their part, out of that come you and I, who are capable of creating this world inside ourselves, this mental spiritual world of ours. And it is we who create the whole of the transcendent world, the whole of that so-called spiritual world. You will ask, good heavens, is it a will-o'-the-wisp then? No, it's not a will-o'-the-wisp. You will ask, how is it then related to this blind thing, to this which seems to be quite the opposite of God, of truth, of transcendence, of beauty, of loveliness, peace, harmony, and all the rest of it? How do you relate it? Look, there is a wholly real, living, vital relationship between what seem to us as irreconcilable opposites. This blind thing, energy, which science calls energy, or which you might call matter or radiation or whatever you like, brought this into being. This living person. And every manifestation of the functioning of his awareness, of his consciousness, is intimately tied up with the actual physical brain. And as such, there are always electrochemical processes going on. No such processes, then no entry into the world of imagination. You can have the most fantastic imagination you like. You can imagine all kinds of things, weird and wonderful and wish-fulfilling or whatever you like. But whatsoever you imagine, whatsoever you think, is associated with electrochemical processes in the brain which affect the whole body. There is a substantial reality involved in it all. When one enters the religious field in earnest and gets free of all the different illusory images that clutter the mind, and one realizes what the Buddhists call nirvana, what the Hindu called Brahman or Atma, moksha, liberation, what the Christian calls fellowship with God and so forth. When you do that, you have released a new power into operation throughout the world. Because that realization cannot take place without you, the living being, with a brain, with a body through which electrochemical processes are going on. There is a total relationship, a binding together of that which seems to be, as the ordinary philosopher would call it, utterly idealistic and non-existent objectively. He would say, oh, this is purely subjective, there is nothing objective about it. But it's the philosopher and I who am talking, or you who are listening, who will separate subjective and objective. It is convenient to do so for talking, it is convenient to do so within certain contexts. But in terms of total reality, it is not so. Total reality is one total reality. We haven't begun to scratch the surface of knowledge yet. We don't know. We're wonderfully ignorant. There's a delight about it. It's marvelous to be so ignorant. Therefore, the religious who goes along such lines and arrives at such inner freedom, the freedom from domination by all the different ideas and conceptions and so forth, is releasing freedom in the true sense, in the grand sense possible to mankind, into the world. He is the one who sees that the whole world process is just one process, a process of totality, the total reality. And when he really sees that, from within him is released the ability, quite naturally, to be unresisting to that process. Then what happens? He lives so completely in every moment of time that he himself is eternity-centered, but moving through time at the same rate at which time is moving. This is something quite extraordinary. It is really entirely transcendent, immanent, simultaneously. Because the realization of eternity through complete living in that moment is the transcendent aspect, but it moves completely in step with time. It's never out of step with time. Therefore, this painful separation between time and eternity is out. Now, the life that one lives in this condition, in this state, is the life which is spontaneously, naturally, creatively good, happy, at peace. It is good, it is happy, it is peaceful, with a goodness and a happiness and a peacefulness to which none of our thought-out criteria or judgments apply. And such a person is a natural center out of whom go forth forces that transform the world. You see, one of its tremendous implications, I do nothing. I can do nothing. But when this limited self-conception, this egoistic misperception of our being is out of the picture, totality carries on unobstructed by me. Put it in theistic terms, if you like. God does all the work. We have to become very clever that way, you know. Do nothing. But if we really know how to do nothing, the Lord does everything. See, if we look carefully at our lives, we will see that how this self-conception, this caring for this particular little thing, is the obstruction to real fulfillment, to real living. I try to live, so to say, by the process of killing myself. And I yet have to hear of anyone who ever succeeded, ever since man came on the globe, in doing that. Now you see, if this goodness becomes spontaneous, then what happens? That person is continuously living, to use the commoner garden word, virtuously. The Buddhist would say the silas are manifest through him. Those who belong to the Judeo-Christian tradition will say all the commandments are fulfilled. Especially, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy might, and etc., etc. But if I do that, if I can possibly do that, then the Lord is doing everything. I'm doing nothing else after that. And then there is no struggle, no strife to live according to a laid down ethic. Not that the laid down ethics are wrong. They are entirely right. But they get naturally fulfilled. There is no striving to fulfill them. Again and again the question arises. Arose only yesterday, for instance. Yes, but how am I, in this present world situation, in a world where there is such brutal competition in the commercial world and all the rest of it, how am I to live like this? Because if I do, such and such unpleasant consequences will come. Of course, unpleasant consequences. Now the cat is out of the bag. I don't like what is unpleasant. You see, we may belong to groups, to societies, we may be 60, 70, for, or 384 years we have practiced the virtues, as we call them, but we haven't found nirvana or come to any satisfactory state. Why not? Because inside we have not seen the whole fact. One has to maintain equanimity, complete equanimity. Whatsoever the experiential situation may be, whether of pleasure or of pain, that is our personal task. No one else can do it for us. We are all willing to eat, aren't we? Not only when we are hungry and when we really need food, but just ordinarily, socially, it's fun, it's pleasure, this, that, and the other. And how often we deliberately eat food which gives us a little pain, a little tummy upset or something like that, and say, oh, that's all right, I can take a little soda bic and counteract it. And so I indulge myself in that way. Where food is concerned, I'm prepared to indulge myself. But where the transcendent real is concerned, I'm not prepared to take that which will cause a little bit of pain. Oh no, it must all be pleasurable all the way, dear God. Otherwise, I'll change my allegiance to Allah or somebody else. No, look into this. Look into this very carefully. Because you see, the fact is that there is absolutely nothing for me, now or hereafter, for me as a separate me. This living object, the human being who is named Feroz Mehta, the totality brought him into existence, carries him through what we call so many years, and will reabsorb him completely and utterly at the end, with not a trace of Feroz Mehta as Feroz Mehta anywhere whatsoever, apart from the memories of other people. And I hope they don't have any memories afterwards, because then they'll be living in the past and dragging themselves, they'll be unnecessarily dragging a corpse with them. So that's the actual fact. For this fellow, there is no hereafter, no rewards, no punishments. It is now that one lives. This now is the eternity. The memory of the past, the anticipation of the future, is time in its aspect of stress, pain, misery, sorrow, unfulfillment, frustration, decay, death. But if the memory of the past no longer obstructs, if the anticipation of the future does not act like a carrot drawing the donkey, then time in its reality flows without dominating my awareness in eternity, now, which is now. You get the point? See, you will find life and ecstasy then. An extraordinary peace, an extraordinary joy, which is utterly indescribable, which altogether transcends sensation. You see, man has brought transcendence into life on this planet. I don't know about other planets, I can only speak for this planet. It is man who has brought transcendence here. Transcendence was not a phenomenon which had actually blossomed out until man came on the globe. Isn't it a wonderful thing? So now, this element of transcendence plays its part and will play an increasing part in everything, everywhere, which means that the opposing duals which we see everywhere in this manifested world of duality, the opposing duals will become completely related and harmonized. Harmonized means that both the pain and pleasure aspects of the play of the duals will move in such a manner that there will be harmony. And in that harmony, there is the liberation of man and the fulfillment of man. But nothing for me. The totality goes on. God sowed, God reaps. God enjoys, God suffers. If you want to put it in theistic terms. To put it in more realistic terms, the unknown totality, the absolute all, which will include God, which is the expression of transcendence, and which will include blind energy, which is the expression of what we commonly call matter, the origin of matter. They will all, as a totality, it's only the totality that lives, and it lives immortally. There is no such thing as immortality or reward for me. This is very important. If we can get rid of this selfness, we shall be free of fear. This petty little selfness. And it takes all sorts of forms. The passion to do good in the world, help this person, that person, etc., etc., etc. Beware of the passion to do good. You'll find it much easier to deal with all the urges to do bad. This is the truth. But you see, just as we wear nice clothes, clean clothes, lovely ties, beautiful jewels and all that, and adorn ourselves in order to hide blemishes sometimes, you see, so do spiritually. The great cause, the happiness it will bring so and so, the enlightenment it will release, and all the usual claptrap. Awake to reality, the total reality. And then, it is not that all problems will be solved. There is no question of vegetating like cabbages in a kind of ecstatic fool's paradise. It is not that all problems will be solved, but inevitably the resolution of all problems, not their solution so much, as their resolution will emerge, when your self-centered in eternity will move completely in step with time. And this is the world process. You see, our static conceptions of an end, and this is the finish, and at last the thing is done to perfection, they are hopelessly wrong. Those are all dead ends, and we have to be free of them. Then goodness will flower, inevitably flower. Happiness will be there, peace will be there. But it necessitates looking very deeply, very intensely. And remember, there is no end to the looking. One has to look continuously. When I go out into the street walking, I can't look for 1 minute and then shut my eyes for 5 minutes whilst I'm walking. I can't. I dare not do that. Something would happen. It's the same with the spirit. New world now. a new age. A new decade has started. And we don't know how things will move. But always, life, the great life wave, brings creative renewal through those who are awake. Such people are the children of the new dawn. And they are continuously children of the new dawn. And it's a dawn which is everlastingly a dawn. Everlastingly fresh, innocent, invincible, because it is totally unresisting. That is why it is invincible. It doesn't oppose, it doesn't conflict, it just is. See, all the great religious teachers and the whole of religion is concerned with our happiness. Make no mistake about that. Everybody wants happiness for himself, and somebody will want happiness for themselves as well as for several other people, many other people, and so forth. But that is not enough. Okay, so just being it. The acceptance of the totality, the understanding of the totality, the being completely related to the totality, being awake to it. That is the state of happiness. Don't picture how it will be. So this new decade has started. And each one of us can be a center, an unresisting center through whom that great life wave will fulfill itself. Whosoever resists gets broken. And unfortunately, there are too many millions in the world who are like that, all the time resisting. They cannot be made unresisting by anybody else. But the unresisting ones themselves will inevitably influence the resisting ones. Leave it to life, to totality, to do the needful with everyone. But oneself be the real thing. And its final effect, if you like, it's absurd to talk in terms of a final effect, but within the limited context, what does all this do? It just enables us to live the good life, that's all. The good life as put forth with childlike simplicity. Don't hurt anybody. Don't steal. Don't be jealous. Don't be hateful, resentful. And that's all there is to it. But just be this in fullness and see what happens to the world.